esenciales.
Hola, Tomás. ¿Qué tal? Muchas gracias por tu pregunta.
Hello, Thomas. How are you? Thank you very much for your question. Well, in reality, the occupation generally limits the entire population with its policies of apartheid and population exhaustion. Women especially are affected in accessing basic health services, especially when we are in a process that, in itself, by the act of being woman, we give birth to children. So many times in these conditions, we have to go through checkpoints that are control points. They limit our ability to move. And when it comes to accessing a hospital at a critical and necessary moment, such as giving birth and bringing a new life to the world, they prohibit such facilities from us. Many times, many women have to be at checkpoints waiting intentionally to be able to give birth, and they cannot be cared for in a correct or healthy way for a woman. Accessing the university often also becomes a problem because the universities are a focus of attention for the occupation because they are concerned that there will be movements from the universities. So every time women want to go to universities, their capacity for movement and their capacity for activism are limited. In itself, the occupation causes the unemployment rate to go up among women in Palestine, and we are very dependent on external aid. Women usually do not have good conditions throughout the world just because of being a woman, so we have to fight.
Good afternoon. I am Patricia Requena from the Living Community Culture Movement. My question is about what type of violence specific to the condition of women they are suffering under the Israel occupation.
Muchas gracias por tu pregunta.
Thank you very much for your question. Well, look, I tell you, since the beginning of the occupation, women, due to their condition as women, have been doubly affected by the Israeli occupation. Since the first massacres that we had in Palestine in 1948 and forced displacement of people from their homes, the occupation tried to create fear in people so that they would not return. For that, women were raped or killed. They raped them, they opened the guts of pregnant women, they took out the fetuses from inside, and that can only be perpetuated by the fact of being a woman. Today, with the aggression that this race is suffering, the genocide that is being committed against them, women are in a particularly vulnerable situation because I think you are aware that medicines, basic fuel, electricity, any kind of medicine are not entering right now. The supply of necessities that makes life possible is limited. This means that hospitals are not functioning and women, by virtue of being women, are forced to give birth in subhuman living conditions without anesthesia. And this does not end there because many women give birth through cesarean section under the pressure of war and it requires cutting them raw. They are opening and taking the children out raw and they are suffering these pains for being a woman. It is something that they have to be dealing with in a very particular way. We shouldn't forget about the importance of psychological damage that these conditions bring in. Then women are also now often left with newborn children whom they cannot breastfeed and who are dying of hunger because the entry of food into Gaza Strip is also prohibited. On the other hand, women right now are not having access to the basic intimate hygiene products that a woman must have, and this condition humiliates them. It is very much humiliating for women to be seen with menstruation bloodstains all over the clothes every day. In the West Bank, the occupation constantly makes fun of this situation. It humiliates Palestinian women. As women, we already have an internal struggle. But with the occupation around it, it is much more difficult to stay focused on our goals.
Nos cuesta muchísimo más de tener el foco bien enfocado.
Muchas gracias, Zaida.
Thank you very much, Zaida. We appreciate that you have accepted this invitation, and I invite you to take a short break so that in the next section we can continue talking about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile.
Your option, our task.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
This title given to the 11th Imam, Al-Askari, is because of a military camp.
Al-Kindi, he was a philosopher who lived during the time of Imam Hassan Al-Askari. When he gets there, he finds Imam moving towards a community who are anticipating him.
This is Dialogue, an introduction on the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari, alayhi salam, the father of the 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, was the 11th Imam of the Infallible Imams from the Ahlul Bayt of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. The blessed and pious Imam carried the banner of Islam, undertook the goals of the religion, and sacrificed his life unto this way. He was indeed a fountainhead of knowledge and wisdom. He faced many incredible difficulties and tragedies and hardships in order to spread and promote and keep intact the high values and goals of the religion of Islam. Truly, there are so many countless favors that have been bestowed upon the Muslims by the divinely appointed Imams, the infallible and immaculate Imams, including Imam Hassan al-Askari, alayhi salam. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of the 11th divinely appointed Imam, the father of the savior of humanity, and we're talking about Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Askari, alayhi salam. So, when talking about the 11th divinely appointed Imam, of course, we find that they did live in an era where it was quite suffocating for them. The Abbasid Caliphate had come down incredibly hard upon the Shias of Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, and of course they also came down really hard upon the 11th divinely appointed Imam. Of course they feared the inherent power of the Imam, they feared the power of the followers of the Imam, and of course along with this they also feared the weakness of their own governments. And so they knew that their governments were based upon oppression, they were based upon tyranny, they were based upon lies and deceit and greed and jealousy and lust. And so they knew very well that these things upon which their empire stands and from which their power stems from is all falsehood. And as the Holy Quran says, surely falsehood will be eradicated. And on the other hand, the power of Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam stemmed from divinity. It stemmed from the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who is the all-powerful and who gives power to whom he wishes. So it's interesting, there was a conversation between Imam Askari alayhi salam as one of his companions, and the companion, it's interesting, he said that I didn't even verbally speak with Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. He said that I didn't even write His Eminence a letter. He said that I was in dire need, financial need, you know, and I wanted to ask Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam to help me out, you know, if he could give me some money so that I could make ends meet pretty much at that time. But he says that I felt embarrassed and I felt shy to go to the divinely appointed Imam and to ask him for money. So he says that eventually I arrived in my home, and when I got to my home, I saw that 100 dinars had been sent to me and they were inside my house. So 100 dinars, of course, you have a dirham and you have a dinar, and so 100 dinars is quite a bit of money. And so he says that when I saw the money that was there in my house, I also went and I saw that there was a letter with that money. And in the letter, it said, if you need something, do not feel shy or embarrassed or refrain from asking us. Ask and you shall get what you like, inshallah. And so this was a letter from Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam to his companion telling him, you know, that we know what kind of a situation you are in. And at the end, we just pray that the Almighty Allah helps us and that the Imam of our time also listens to us, which he does, and he helps us through our difficult times. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Salim Yusuf Ali.
We know that at the end of the life of the Imam alayhi salam, that just like the other Imams before him, the Khulafa were unable to bear their presence and they had to resort, you know, and they found a justification to try to blot out the light of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. And they thought in doing so they would find their happiness and their success, but actually it only made situation worse for them, and they eventually had to exit from the scene. We're told that the Khalifa, that he had poisoned the Imam alayhi salam. So one of the reports says here that when the Imam alayhi salam was afflicted with the poison, that it was so much that even his blessed hand was shaking, and it was such that he couldn't even, you know, bring the glass of water to his own lips. So we're told, according to one report, that he tells one of his companions that go to the room and tell my son that his father is calling him. And when the companion goes to the room, he sees that the Imam of our time, who's a child at that time, that he is in sujood, he is doing sajda. He says to him that your father is calling you. And the Imam of our time comes to the service of his father. And when Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam sees his son, he cries and he says, Ya Sayyid Ahli Zamanihi, O the leader of the people of his time, Isqin al-Ma, help me drink some water, Fa inni dhahibun ila Rabbi, because I am going to my Lord. Imagine this scene here of the Imam alayhi salam with his son, and towards the end of his life, he's seeing his own son, the Imam of our time, and he is feeding him that water. On this night, we ask the Imam Askari alayhi salam, we say that, O Imam, we ask you to be our Shafi, we ask you to be our intercessor, and we come to you, and we hope that we are true to being followers of your son. One of the reports says that there was once a man who was imprisoned, and he wrote to Imam Askari alayhi salam, and he says to him that "Oh my Imam, I'm in prison. Do something so I can be freed." And the Imam alayhi salam sends him a letter, and he says that the very afternoon that you receive this letter, you will be freed from prison. And sure enough, he's freed from prison. We say to Imam Askari alayhi salam that we are prisoners to so many things, our own desires. We are prisoners to the dunya. We are prisoners to the worries that have burdened us and prevented us from connecting to Allah and from worshipping Him freely. We are prisoners to the distractions and the delights of this dunya. Oh, our Imam, we ask you to seek intercession with Allah so we can be freed from this prison of this dunya.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Kamala Harris has a big lead over Donald Trump among early voters in the United States. The lead is larger than the one Hillary Clinton had over Donald Trump in the 2016 election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Telegraph has covered this story and tells us more. Kamala Harris has a big lead over Donald Trump among American voters who say they have already cast their ballots, according to opinion polls. The Democratic nominee had an advantage of 19 to 29 percentage points over her Republican rival, according to tallies by ABC News and Ipsos, New York Times and Siena College, and CNN. The lead is larger than the one Hillary Clinton had over Donald Trump in the run-up to the 2016 election, when polls showed the Democratic nominee leading with 8 to 16 percentage points. Joe Biden had a greater margin in late 2020 polls, when Democrats embraced mail voting. While Donald Trump attacked it and persuaded his supporters not to do it, polling shows that Kamala Harris has a significant advantage in swing states where the two parties have similar levels of support and where the outcome of the election will be decided. According to polls from Marist, CNN, Fox News and USA Today, Suffolk University, Kamala Harris leads among early voters in the key battlegrounds of Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Only in Nevada does any major poll indicate an early Donald Trump swing state advantage, with a CNN study showing a 6 percentage point lead. There has been Republican excitement over increased levels of early voting by their supporters, which led billionaire businessman Elon Musk to declare that Donald Trump was trending towards a crushing victory. 4 years ago, Trump was vehemently opposed to early and mail-in voting, saying it was vulnerable to fraud. This time around, Donald Trump and Republican Party officials have adapted their messaging to encourage supporters to cast their ballots before Election Day next Tuesday. Elon Musk's prediction was based on a comparison from Pennsylvania of 2024, vote-by-mail turnout against turnout levels from this point in the 2020 race, which showed registered Republicans making up 32% of the early vote compared with 21% back in 2020. Early voting data tends to favor Democrats as the party encourages its supporters to cast their ballots early, so less is left a chance on Election Day. Women are also voting early in large numbers, and Democrats, who have made reproductive rights a central campaign issue, see the female vote as key to a Kamala Harris victory. According to the University of Florida's Election Laboratory, 54% of the 60 million Americans who have already voted are women. Kamala Harris led Donald Trump by 12 percentage points among female voters in October, according to an analysis by Reuters and Ipsos. Experts warned against overinterpreting early polling data as the subsamples of those who say they have already submitted their ballot have larger margins of error. Mail-in voting and early voting began at scale in the United States during the Civil War, but has been a significant expansion since 2000. Most states offer in-person and mail voting, though options vary. The latest opinion polls indicate that the candidates are neck and neck in the home stretch of the race. Assassination attempts, the dropping out of the incumbent, criminal convictions, and a record-breaking donation haul, the 2024 U.S. presidential election cycle is a roller coaster ride. With just a matter of days to go until Americans head to the polls on 5th of November next Tuesday, the Telegraph is tracking the race at every turn. Kamala Harris had long maintained a lead over Donald Trump after Joe Biden withdrew and endorsed her as a Democratic nominee, according to our national polling aggregates. But the space between them is vanishing with each day the election draws nearer. British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. Donald Trump trails Kamala Harris by between 19 and 29 percentage points among those who say they've already cast their ballots, according to the latest opinion polls. Despite Donald Trump's boasts of an unprecedented lead in early voting, polling suggests that Kamala Harris is actually significantly ahead among those who have already voted, either through absentee, mail-in, or in-person ballots. Recent national polling from ABC News and Ipsos, the New York Times and Siena College, and CNN show that Kamala Harris leads Donald Trump 62% to 33%, 59% to 40%, and 61% to 36% respectively, according to analysis by the Washington Post. According to these polls, those who have already voted are nearly twice as likely to have voted for Kamala Harris, with a 24% lead among early voters. The same trend is also true across almost all of the swing states, according to surveys from CNN, Fox News, Morris Poll, and USA Today's Suffolk University. The polls find that Kamala Harris is leading in early voting across Arizona, between 9 and 12%, Georgia between 7 and 10%, Michigan between 26 and 39%, North Carolina between 2 and 6%, Pennsylvania between 17 and 35%, and Wisconsin between 22 and 60%. CNN's polling of those who said they've already voted has found that Donald Trump leads Kamala Harris in Nevada by 6 percentage points. Early voting records have been smashed already this election cycle, with 65 million Americans estimated to have cast their ballots already, according to the University of Florida. An estimated 65% of likely voters either have or intend to cast their ballot before Election Day next Tuesday. Excitement in the GOP camp is mounting As opinion polls show, Republicans have embraced early voting much more than in 2020, when Donald Trump dissuaded the use of mail-in ballots, despite the U.S. being in the depths of the COVID pandemic. In Pennsylvania, for example, registered Republicans make up about 32% of early vote this year, a significant increase from 21% back in 2020, according to CNN. Trump has claimed that his party is in fact storming ahead in the polls among early voters. Donald Trump speaking at Henderson, Nevada, a campaign stop on Thursday, 31st of October, said, "We're leading in early voting for the first time ever. As you know, Democrats always lead in the early part, and Republicans like to go there on." Despite enhanced GOP voter turnout, Kamala Harris is expected to go into Election Day with a substantial lead, according to the latest opinion polls.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
After the wars of Israel and the repeated defeats of Arabs, Israel seeks to consolidate its permanent position. It expels Palestinians, hides documents, forges records, and seizes empty lands. Then it transfers Jews from other countries to Israel to form the lower classes of society as cheap labor. On the other side, Palestinians, after forced migration, set up camps in neighboring countries. The camps were supposed to be temporary until the time the Palestinians were able to return to their motherland. But the camps have turned into permanent settlements.
My father died 20 years ago, and we were very small. We were all children, four children with our mother. And my mother wasn't working. Then we grew up and we began to work until we could make our house completely with its furniture and to live like the other people, not in the high society, but like other people. And now at once, all of it together, nothing at all, under the sun, under the sky.
Conditions in the camps are not suitable, and the residents are under economic pressure.
They are frustrated, you see, and I think these people have lost confidence in everybody in this world.
Palestinian fighters based in Jordan infiltrate their motherland and carry out armed operations. In March 1968, after the armed operations of the fighters, Israel attacks the Palestinian camp Karameh in Jordan and destroys everything. In the aftermath, tensions increase. Palestinian fighters are transferred to Lebanon. The economic and social conditions in Lebanon are not suitable. Social activists such as Imam Musa Sadr strive for unity, coherence, and alleviation of deprivation, but the political groups are not united. They do not have long-term plans. Each group and front is seeking its own fame and benefit. They compete with each other and do not tolerate one another's presence. Worst of all, they do not realize Israel's policies.
40,000
On the 3rd of April, 1975, leader of a Christian party was the subject of an assassination attempt, but he survives unharmed. In retaliation for this attack, Palestinian fighters are attacked the same day. The clashes escalate and the civil wars in Lebanon begin. Imam Musa Sadr's plans are adversely influenced.
18 months of bitter fighting saw the Christians' very existence threatened.
Israel, which hails the war in turmoil in Lebanon, implements its own plans. In 1978, Israel attacks Lebanon under the pretext of preventing Palestinian attacks.
Now, if you like to come with me, I will show you where the airplanes are shooting the people. Exactly, you can see with your eyes, you see? That's what I like you to prove, that's to all the people. No bread, no food, not even water, no electricity, nothing, nothing. We are alone. We have nothing. We need everything.
Israel deploys a mercenary group in Lebanon and retreats from the country. In 1981, Menachem Begin, the Prime Minister of Israel, appoints one of his most ruthless individuals as the Minister of Military Affairs, Ariel Sharon. Sharon had a long history of crime and violence and was known for saying, "Destroy everything that can be destroyed." Sharon designs a plan not only to put an end to Palestinian resistance, but also to change the geographical shape of the region. Initially, Israel launches scattered attacks, and finally, on June 6, 1982, a widespread attack begins. 120,000 soldiers, along with 3,200 tanks and armored vehicles, suddenly enter Lebanese territory. They quickly reach Palestinian camps in Sur and Sidon. The war breaks out and Palestinian fighters resist. At the same time, Israel also attacks Syrian forces. With pressure from Israel on the Lebanese parliament, Bashir Gemayel is elected as president. Israel's objectives for attacking Lebanon become clear: occupying Lebanese territory, expelling Palestinians, suppressing Syrians, and establishing a puppet government in Lebanon. At Lebanon's request, foreign forces enter to oversee the departure of Palestinians. After the departure of Palestinian fighters, foreign forces also leave Lebanon. Subsequent events quickly unfold. Bashir Gemayel is killed in a bombing. The Israelis immediately besiege the Palestinian camps. Then they incite the Falangists to act against the Palestinians. The Falangists enter the camps and carry out an unprecedented massacre. At that time, at least 90,000 Palestinians were in the camps, most of whom were 1948 refugees. The Israelis oversee the operations and even illuminate the camps at night with floodlights to continue the massacre even throughout the night. The killers carry fake identification cards, and it is never clear how many of them were Israelis and how many were Lebanese. Israel was intoxicated with victories. It called southern Lebanon the northern boundary of the Jordan River and beat the drum of victory. But these crimes had consequences. The region was awaiting new disasters. Heavy rain falls in the city of Tyre. Israeli soldiers gather inside the command building. Moments later, a vehicle enters the building and immediately explodes. 140 Israeli officers and soldiers are killed as a result of the intensity of the blast. Sometime later, in the spring of 1983, another explosion takes place, this time at the U.S. Embassy. In this explosion, CIA officers are also killed. This is considered the second attack on embassies. In the fall of 1983, two more explosions occur. The casualties of Israeli and American forces mount. Scattered attacks on Israeli forces continue. In 1984, Shia cleric Sheikh Raghib Harb is assassinated and martyred by three mercenaries. Following that, Israel attacks the villages, destroying homes and killing unarmed people. These events are considered part of Israel's revenge. In 1985, Hezbollah officially declares its existence in Lebanon and calls Israel an occupier. For the first time, Israel faces a cohesive, unified, and organized group. While the resistance force has shown itself off in Lebanon, despair and hopelessness prevail in Palestinian territories. No individual or organization is able or desires to help Palestine. The economic conditions of Palestinians worsens by the day. Zionist oppression and disrespect are darted towards Palestinian life. Palestinian workers are run over by a truck and four people are killed. Many others are injured and the community becomes infuriated. During the funerals, clashes erupt. Palestinians attack Israelis with stones. 17-year-old student Mohammed Hatem Abu Sisi is killed by Israel. The clashes heighten and people rise up in a revolutionary movement. The First Intifada. From within the First Intifada, the Hamas resistance movement led by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin takes shape. Israel wants to suppress the movement, but that is beyond its strength. The solution lies in negotiations. Israel needs peace to restore power. Israel's demands are met. The issue of Al-Quds and the return of Palestinians are set aside for the time being. The confrontation between the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, and Israel comes to an end. A self-governing authority is formed, which is simply distant from the ideal of Al-Quds, aiming to pacify the Palestinians. This is considered a form of silent repression. When Israel feels safe from Palestinians, its attention turns away towards a new player from Lebanon, Hezbollah. During Israel's attacks, Lebanon's economic and social conditions were not favorable. Israel did whatever it wanted. It abducted ordinary people, murdering them in Lebanese territories. However, Hezbollah's resistance forces Israel to retreat. The first prisoner swap operation takes place. Hezbollah is able to free its forces from Israel. While everyone is celebrating Hezbollah's success, a bitter incident occurs. The Israeli army targets a car, killing its passengers. In this incident, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, along with his family, are all martyred. Sayyid Abbas Mousawi was aware of the dangers but he had decided to be with his family despite Israel's probable attack. As the leader of Hezbollah martyred, Israel thought the job was done. However, subsequent events show strategic miscalculation on Israel's part. In the 1990s, Hezbollah's resistance continues. Israel decides to directly fight Hezbollah. Israel's military attack on Lebanon starts under the pretext of Hezbollah's dangers to Israel. The attack is called Operation Grapes of Wrath. Lebanon is heavily bombarded. Amid the bitter incidents, a more tragic event than war occurs. A group of defenseless people is settled in a place called Qana, where only women and children are present. Qana is attacked, and Lebanese women and children are martyred. The terrifying tragedy burdened Israel with immense pressure. The war is halted by Hezbollah's resistance. In 1999, a piece of news is published in the media. The infiltration of Israeli forces into Lebanese territory has been met with failure. This incident is unbelievable. Hezbollah's success lies in its media portrayal of its victories. Hezbollah releases various images of its operations, which reveal the realities of the battlefield. The media operations increase Israel's costs, and in 2000, Israel withdraws from Lebanon and adopts a policy of assassination. Shortly after, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, leader of Hamas, is assassinated. Then Rafik Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, is liquidated. In 2006, while Hezbollah is accused of involvement in the assassinations and media attacks against it soar, an incident occurs at the borders. Israeli soldiers on patrol at the Lebanese border are attacked. Two Israeli soldiers are taken captive. The Zionists quickly react, but Israel's reaction comes with casualties. Israel declares war on Lebanon and attacks Lebanon by land, sea, and air, especially on the southern area of Beirut, Dahiya. The 33-day war begins. The casualties of the 33-day war are numerous. However, the important point is Hezbollah does not surrender and responds to Israeli attacks in every possible way. Although the war does not yield any achievements for Israel, it keeps on attacking everywhere. In fact, Israel's war plan was somewhat similar to America's military operations in Serbia and Afghanistan. But this plan is doomed to failure. Experts believe Israeli attack on Lebanon was a mistake. However, hardliners did not allow the right decisions to be made. They were the ones who said Israel needed to show its strength to restore its image after the events of 2000 and the withdrawal from Lebanon. They said Israel's goal is to display power. America supported Israel's policy and, along with Britain, blocked a ceasefire in the hope that Hezbollah might suffer defeat. They thought that roughly within a week, everything would come to an end, but it was not so. Israel was defeated in this war. Martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, then the Secretary General of Hezbollah, was giving a speech, and in every speech, he struck a blow to Israel. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's revelations about Israel ended up with Israel's loss. Israel also suffered a defeat in politics. Hezbollah did not want and would not allow the bitter memories of the 1967 war to be repeated. Revisiting reports conducted by Israelis depicts the real scene of the battle. Hezbollah and Hamas capture Israeli soldiers. Israel comes into play. However, its tanks are being destroyed one by one. The casualty rate rises. The Israeli Air Force gets into action. Then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert threatens to wage full-scale war on Lebanon. Other than targeting Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, they attack any target in Lebanon. Another Israeli official says if Hezbollah soldiers do not retreat, they will turn Lebanon back 20 years. All the events happen quickly, and Israeli authorities make decisions rapidly and implement each decision right away. In the middle of the war, it becomes clear that Israeli analysts were right. Waging war on Lebanon was a mistake. In contrast to Israel's hasty decisions, Hezbollah had a special order and discipline. But Israel was not ready to accept defeat. It attacked relentlessly. The war continues. In the heat of Israel's attacks, an Israeli warship in the Mediterranean Sea explodes. Israel is caught off guard. Observers realize something has changed in Hezbollah's battle with Israel. But the Israeli regime doesn't realize that. An Israeli soldier later says, "We didn't know what was happening and what was hitting us. We only knew that we were being killed." They thought that perhaps Hezbollah forces were stationed in desert tents with AK-47s, but during the military attack, the soldiers were faced with hydraulic steel doors and a network of intricate tunnels. An Israeli soldier later confesses, "I am ashamed to admit that we drank water from Hezbollah's headquarters and went into local shops to eat." Of course, Israeli soldiers looted the shops. The advice of people like then Israeli War Minister Benjamin Ben Eliezer for the attack from the beginning was wrong. America is pursuing a rapid ceasefire because Israel needs to make up for its lost power. During the talks, Israel attacks again. But this attack also fails, and Israel is forced to accept a UN resolution. In the final 72 hours of the war, Israel launches around 1 million cluster bombs. The number of cluster bombs is so high that even after the ceasefire, ordinary people were falling victim to these bomblets and killed. But this does not hide Israel's defeat from the eyes of experts. Experts said that Hezbollah did a great job. Hezbollah is not afraid of Israel. The 33-day war becomes Israel's first defeat. Later, American journalist Seymour Hersh reveals the Bush administration was closely involved in planning Israel's military operations. The war with Hezbollah was a simulation of America's attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, and it was considered a kind of exercise. According to experts, the 33-day war becomes a turning point in the military and war equations and has a significant impact on the region's subsequent events. Ben-Gurion believed that Israel should not be defeated in any war. and if defeated, it will be victorious in no war afterwards.
Abon 13th, the Day of God. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, hello and welcome to the program. Today is 13th of the Iranian month of Abon, a day on which three vital events in the struggles of the Iranian people for freedom from foreign hegemony and domestic despotism took place, beginning with the exile in 1964 of the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God bless him, and culminating in 1979 in the capture of the U.S. den of spies in Tehran by revolutionary students. Stay with us for a special feature in this regard on the day that is celebrated as the Day of National Campaign Against Global Arrogance. The 13th of Aban is indeed one of those glorious days in the history of Iran, which the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, had hailed as Yomullah, or the Day of God. That sage of the age who restored to Iran its religious, national, cultural, political, scientific, social, and economic prestige meant whatever he said. He was not playing with words as politicians who get elected for a term or two and then fade away from the scene do with eyes only on the people's vote, while the heart and intentions might not tally with what they speak. As a loyal servant of the Prophet of Islam and the infallible Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, peace upon them, Sayyid Ruhullah Musavi, through his sheer dedication to the dynamic teachings of Islam, had achieved the status of ijtihad, or independent reasoning on the basis of the Holy Quran and Hadith, and then risen to higher degrees to become the Wali-e-Faqih, or the supreme jurist, who is always cognizant of the presence of God, the Omnipresent. Thus, it was divine inspiration which made him use the term Day of God for the day on which the den of spies in Tehran fell to Muslim students who, by seizing top secret documents, foiled a dangerous plot to overthrow the Islamic Republic system of government and in the process expose to the whole world the satanic nature of the administrations that march in and out of the White House. Now, we know why this man of God used another divinely inspired term, Great Satan, to designate U.S. administrations, whether Republicans or Democrats. Imam Khomeini meant to say that Iranians and all the world's oppressed should always be vigilant of the plots of the U.S. and never allow it to infiltrate their societies, since humanity is faced with a monster that is more mischievous than its master, Lucifer, the outcast. The bleak, black, and bloody record of the U.S. speaks for itself. It includes the criminal dropping of atomic bombs on Japan, when the Second World War was almost over, overthrowing popular governments such as Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh of Iran in 1953 massacring the people of Vietnam for over a decade and a half, instructing Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad to impose the 8-year war on the Islamic Republic of Iran, resorting to state terrorism to reduce Afghanistan to thraldom, patronizing the illegal Zionist entity, creating through client regimes a string of terrorist outfits like Daesh in Syria and Iraq to destabilize Muslim lands, tarnishing the image of Islam and breaking its promise to remove all illegal sanctions clamped on Iran. That is the reason the present leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, as the loyal disciple of Imam Khomeini, said, "Iblis, Lucifer, or the Satan only tempts mankind to commit sins and crimes, but the US as the great Satan practically wreaks havoc on humanity and destroys all humanitarian values." He said our enmity is with the satanic nature of the US administrations and not with the American people, who are also oppressed by the regime in the White House. So, when we say death to the US, we mean the satanic elements that run it. It should be recalled that on this day in 1964, the detested British installed an American-backed Pahlavi potentate under instructions of his masters, exiled to Turkey, the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, in the vain hope of perpetuating American hegemony over Iran. The rest is history. The Imam soon moved to neighboring Iraq to take up residence in Najaf, near the holy shrine of the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, from where he inspired the Iranian people to stage their epic uprisings against the US Zionist domination of the country. In 1978, on this fateful day, when it was clear to all that it was only a matter of time for the Pahlavi regime to be swept into oblivion, the US stooge, at the behest of his overlords in Washington, ordered the massacre of students at Tehran University who were staging a peaceful rally calling for return home from exile of their beloved leader, Imam Khomeini. The bloody event backfired so badly on US designs that 2 months later, the hated Shah was forced to flee Iran, and on February 1st, the Imam returned to lead the Islamic Revolution to its resounding triumph. In 1979 came the crowning moment for Aban 13th, when the revolutionary students stormed the espionage den, caught the spies red-handed in the act of shredding documents of American crimes, and ended once and for all any undesirable US presence on the sacred soil of Iran. Imam Khomeini hailed the memorable move as the second revolution that was without the least doubt necessary for proper materialization of the rule of the Iranian people over their own affairs. Thus, in view of these undeniable facts, it is all the more necessary to keep alive the sweet memories of the fall of the US den of espionage. Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.